True crime horror story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 5, Episode 5, Cannibals Part 7. Part 1, The Hills Have Eyes. Go ye not by Galawa. Come bide a while, my friend. I'll tell ye of the dangers there. Beware a Sawney Bean.
Wanted to see something different, but something different saw them first. The hills have eyes.
Mister, don't take your family back in that area. The silver has been gone for 40 years now. Besides, there's nothing back in there but animals.
In his Chronicles of England, Scotland, and Ireland, published in 1570, Raphael Holinshed tells the tale of a Scottish cannibal called Tristacloak, who committed his crimes in 1341, sparing neither women nor children from his feasting mouth. Later that decade, Robert Lindsay published History and Chronicles of Scotland, telling a similar culinary tale but dating his narrative back to 1460. The first confirmed written account of our subject, one Sawney Bean, dates back to 1734 in Charles Johnson's A General and True History of the Lives and Sections of the Most Famous Highwaymen, Murderers, Street Robbers, etc. in 1734. This story was elaborated in an 18th century penny dreadful known as the Newgate Calendar, a sort of true crime magazine of its time. The most popular and generally accepted version of Sawney Bean's story, however, is found in John Nicholson's Historical and Traditional Tales Connected with the South of Scotland, published in 1843. Perhaps more folklore than fact, the legend of Sawney Bean dates back to the 15th century, when Scotland was under the reign of King James I. Alexander Sawney Bean was the son of a hedge layer and ditch digger, born in East Lothian, Scotland, just east of Edinburgh, sometime between 1385 and 1390. Like many of his countrymen, he had a shock of red hair, and folks tended to simply call him Sawney, an old Scots term for sandy. While his father was a hard-working peasant, Sawney himself was prone to idleness, and if he wasn't idle, he was unruly. When Sawney was older, he met a woman called Black Agnes Douglas, named possibly because her sour disposition matched that of her lovers, or, as some legends state, because she was known to dabble in witchcraft. Whatever the reason for her nickname of Black, the two were drawn to one another and certainly brought out the worst in each other. Together, they were too disorderly not only for their families but also their fellow villagers, and Sawney's parents set him loose when he was still a teen. With no money and no desire to work, the pair made their way to Galloway, now in South Ayrshire, on the southwest coast of Scotland, robbing their way across the countryside. Eventually, the two settled in a cave in Benane Head, at the foot of a steep cliff. Stretching for almost a mile, the hollow was the perfect hideout for outlaws such as the Beans, as the cave mouth allowed the tide to come in some 200 yards twice a day, keeping it hidden, and it contained numerous passages, dead ends, and large rooms in which to hide from society and from the law. However, as their family grew, the robbing and stealing from passerby and travelers was not enough to sustain the Bean clan. Sawney contemplated becoming a cattle thief, but that was simply too dangerous and would likely end with him hanging from the end of a rope. Selling the spoils from his victims in town wouldn't work either, as the goods might be recognized. With no money and no food, Sawney made a fateful decision. because dead men tell no tales. In order to remain anonymous, he would have to murder his victims, which in turn would help solve another of the Bean's problems, that of starvation. Now, well-fed, the Bean clan grew tremendously. Sonny and Agnes had 8 sons and 6 daughters, who incestuously created an additional 18 grandsons and 14 granddaughters. There were many mouths to feed, and an average human body would likely yield up to 60 pounds of edible meat, enough to last a month or so. The meat was kept fresh by the culinary skills of Mrs. Bean, who would salt the butchered meat with salt from the ocean or brine it in ocean water, while other parts were smoked over the fire. As the clan picked off travelers from the nearby villages of Lindlefoot and Ballantry, people began to avoid the country roads that ran near Benenane Head. Some local businesses and inns lost patrons, while others closed their doors completely. Missing people were reported to the local authorities, who in turn reported the disappearances to the king's magistrates, but travelers disappearing were not terribly uncommon, and no immediate attention was garnered. The Beans eventually had to stretch out further to bring in more meat for their enormous clan. Their attacks were organized, and rules of engagement had to be followed in order to remain anonymous. The gruesome family would swarm their victims, no more than 6 if on foot, and 2 if on horseback, slit their throats, and drag them back to the cave for butchering. With so many mouths to feed and so many bones left over, the Beans soon had another dilemma. Where could they safely discard all the extra body parts without drawing attention to their location? Occasionally, after a large storm, the tides on Gervan's beaches and the shoreline would be littered with body parts. Human body parts, meticulously butchered like those of slaughtered animals, but most certainly human, their demise most certainly violent. The Bean clan had been disposing of the leftover body parts in the dark of night, tossing them out in the tide to be washed away with the sea. As the inhabitants of Girvan found out, however, they didn't always wash out to sea. Soldiers began patrolling the rural routes along the coast, and landlords and innkeepers were once again questioned. Townspeople even delivered mob justice a time or two, murdering innocent people, but the disappearances continued. In the summer of 1435, a traveling fair came to Galloway. After enjoying the day's festivities, a young couple, whose names are not recorded, was ambushed by the Bean clan on their way home. The man and woman both sat atop one horse, an easy target for the barbarous cannibals. The couple was ruthlessly attacked by the savage horde, who dragged the woman from the horse and swiftly slit her throat, lapping up the blood as if it were a fine wine. They opened her belly and ripped out her entrails, feasting on them then and there. The man reared his horse and was able to draw his sword to fight off the beast. Some versions later say that he had a pistol as well. No matter the weapons he used, the man was able to create enough noise and confusion to draw the attention of another group of fairgoers, some 20 in number, on their journey home. As they approached the melee, the Bean clan fled, outnumbered by the fairgoers. The man, in shock for having witnessed his beloved being ripped to shreds right in front of his eyes, relayed his story to the crowd and showed them the mangled body of his love. It was determined that he had encountered the dreaded Galloway cannibals. The group then escorted the man to Glasgow to repeat his tale to the local magistrates, a hideous story that was confirmed by the traveling fairgoers. The chief magistrate immediately sent a message to King James in Edinburgh, who assembled 400 soldiers and set out immediately for Glasgow. The king, his soldiers, and a pack of bloodhounds arrived 4 days later. The man served as a guide, leading them to the site of the attack. The soldiers searched the roads between Lindlefoot and Ballantry for days. While walking along the beaches, the hounds finally alerted and eagerly led the men to a narrow cave opening at the base of the Benane Heads cliffs. As water trickled in, the soldiers attempted to pull the dogs back, uncertain if the hounds had actually picked up the scent of blood. When the dogs wouldn't budge, the men used torches and entered the cave, swords drawn, just in case. The soldiers searched the dank labyrinth for any sign of the cannibals. Deep within the rocky maze, they came upon a macabre sight, a large den littered with piles of old clothing, trinkets, purses, gold and silver, even swords and other weapons. The most revolting findings of all, however, were the piles and piles of butchered human remains. A messenger was sent to the rest of the troops still stationed outside. They too entered the cave, as many as could fit. The scene was reminiscent of a decrepit butcher shop. Arms, legs, and torsos hung from the ceilings while other body parts sat pickling in barrels or roasting over fires. Deeper and deeper in the cave, the soldiers searched until they finally found the Bean Clan huddled together in the dark, hissing and growling like trapped animals. There were 27 men and 21 women. After a brief struggle, the cannibal family was tethered with chains and taken to Edinburgh. The soldiers gave the body parts as close to a Christian burial as possible before taking the maniacal clan away. The Beans sat in Edinburgh's Tollbooth jail for just one night. There was no trial, as the family was considered too subhuman for such sophisticated procedure. They were taken to Leith, where they were swiftly executed. The women were forced to watch as the men had their arms, legs, and genitals cut off, left to bleed to death. The women were then burned at the stake in three large fires. All the while, the Beans shrieked and cursed those who captured them. Their cannibalistic reign of terror, which lasted approximately 25 years and took some 1,000 lives, was finally at an end.
What began as a vacation ended as a nightmare.
Hell to pay now!
What was that?
Part 2, The Granny Ripper. To most of us, the image conjured up when thinking about a granny is a sweet old lady that is caring and wise and whose cooking and baking is out of this world.
Oh, goody goody, we're taking a trip to Granny's house.
However, anyone who's been to a shop or a market on Pensioner's Day will testify that you should never underestimate the feistiness of the elderly when hunt is on for the perfect ingredients and that little extra discount. Tamara Samsonova knew her way around the kitchen, but what the police would find in their investigations would turn the stomach of any ordinary man inside out. From the history to the weather, we've discovered in our piece on Andrei Chikatilo that Russia is not a country for the weak. Poverty and hardship reigned supreme throughout the Soviet state before and after communism. Today's subject, as it turns out, had a thing for old Andrei, and a busybody neighbor would tell reporters later that Tamara had a kind of hero worship going on when it came to the famous Russian serial killer who had 52 killings under his belt, and whose story you can find in Season 2, Episode 5 of True Crime Horror Story. Tamara Mitrofanova Samsonova's date of birth is either in February or April of 1946, depending on what source you look at. After she finished school, she made the move from Moscow to St. Petersburg, where she met Alexei Samsonova. The two were married and moved into their home on Dimitrov Street in the Frieze District that would become so well known in 1971. She first had a career in tourism and then in the hotel industry, and the couple never had any children. Medical records would later indicate, however, that Tamara had been hospitalized and treated three times in psychiatric hospitals for what doctors diagnosed as a form of schizophrenia. In 2000, Alexei seemed to have vanished into thin air. Tamara would tell anyone who asked that he had an affair and ran away with another woman. Soon afterwards, Tamara started to take in tenants, and in 2003, a 44-year-old man who had been running from her also vanished. It would later emerge that the two had quarreled, and instead of ending the lease agreement, Tamara decided to kill and dismember him. Tenants coming and going at the Dimitrov Street home of Tamara would not seem unusual. That's until the month of July in 2015. Tamara had approached a neighbor of hers, Valentina Ulanova, and asked a 79-year-old dear if she could stay with her, because her own little dwelling was being refurbished. This would later be revealed as an absolute lie, as footage would have shown her apartment untouched, dirty, and full of clutter. At 68, Tamara still had a spring in her step, and she offered to take care of her elderly neighbor and clean around the house in lieu of rent. Valentina agreed, and in the beginning, the arrangement seemed to work for both. The problem arose when Tamara slowed down quickly in her enthusiasm when it came to housework. Valentina complained, and Tamara ignored her. Tamara had fallen in love with her neighbor's abode and decided that she was never going to leave. The bottom finally fell out of this arrangement on July 23, 2015, when Valentina lost her temper about an unwashed cup. Valentina informed Tamara that she needed to pack her belongings and move out. Tamara, on the other hand, had other ideas. Valentina's apartment was much nicer than hers, and she didn't want to leave. She took a 3-hour drive to Pushkin, where she convinced a pharmacist to sell her 50 tablets of a potent schizophrenia medication. On her way back, she picked up one of Valentina's favorite dishes, an Olivier salad, which is basically a potato salad, and she crushed the pills into it, and then went to her room and waited. After hearing her host's body hit the kitchen floor, Tamara wasted no time. She moved into the kitchen and started to dismember the unconscious Valentina. Her favorite instruments to do so were 2 kitchen knives, a hacksaw, and a pair of kitchen scissors. After her capture, she would show detectives, using an orange dummy, how she removed the head and hands first. These she placed in a saucepan to cook, claiming to conceal the identification of the body this way. After dismembering and disemboweling the corpse, she placed the pieces into several trash bags, which she moved from the apartment into the dumpster on the street. CCTV footage reveals the geriatric murderer taking 7 trips to the different dumping sites, leaving the saucepan with the head and hands for the very last. Valentina was a very big lady. The mistake Tamara made was, deciding the hips and legs were too heavy to lift, she unceremoniously hid them behind a bush. It would be a curious dog that would discover the bag during a walk with his owner that would seal her fate. Police were immediately informed of the content, and a social worker was sent to check on Valentina. Tamara refused her entry, and unsettled by the behavior of the so-called caregiver, she alerted the police, and quickly, a search warrant was gained. As we know by now, Tamara was not a neat freak, and judging by the massive amount of blood in the kitchen, it was evident that the body parts found belonged to someone who lost their life in that very home. What sealed the deal is the footage of the Slavic slayer making her way in the baby blue raincoat up and down the stairs with the bags containing limbs. The curtain that was wrapped around the body was also traced back to the home. Numerous books about astrology and black magic were also found there. Suddenly, the strange random discovery of body parts over the last 2 decades in the area was a mystery that just might have been solved. The business card of a tenant who went missing and the pages of confessions in her diary revealed 11 confirmed murders. About his death, she wrote, "I killed my tenant Olivia, cut up his body in the bathroom with a knife, and left the pieces in different parts of the city." The description of that murder, as well as the scribbles in various diaries, led police to be able to connect Tamara to at least 14 unsolved murders and disappearances, including her own husband. She would eventually only be charged and convicted of 2 murders with extreme cruelty, but there's been speculation that she may have killed as many as 22 people. It would later emerge that she confessed to a friend that she not only murdered her husband, but also her mother-in-law, but these claims were never taken too seriously. She was open to discuss her crimes when she was arrested, telling police that she knew Valentina was going to be her last kill. Seems the old lady was finally ready to retire from her murderous career. One part of her disturbing diary that could never be verified was that she claimed to have eaten parts of her victims. In her diary, she claimed to have a specific preference for lungs, which apparently are spongy and not as full of flavor as the kidneys or the liver. Police were dumbfounded by her reaction to her arrest and wondered if she was very stupid or just very clever in the jovial way she accompanied them, claiming that she awaited 20 years for this day to come and that she was glad that it was finally over. Tamara was ordered to have a full psychiatric evaluation done, which revealed that the Granny Ripper did indeed suffer from schizophrenia. The judge ordered her to spend the rest of her life in a psychiatric hospital, and as far as we know, she's still detained at 74. As she left the courthouse, journalists captured images of Tamara blowing kisses at the camera, and she said, "I knew you would come." Part 3, Joachim Kroll, the Semen Troll. A couple of episodes ago, we covered Peter Curtin. His brutal murders and his strange appreciation for blood, much like a sommelier would appreciate a good Pinot Grigio or maybe a Shiraz. It's one of the most brutal cases we have ever covered, and it sort of seemed like an isolated incident. That was until we began to research Joachim George Kroll. Joachim Kroll was born 2 years after his fellow countryman on April 17, 1933. The similarities between the two are eerie, but as you'll learn, Kroll is by far the worst of the two. Where Peter was a skillful, dapper, and intelligent, blood-sucking freak, Kroll was an ugly man with low intelligence and a vile taste for human flesh. He grew up in Hindenburg as the sixth of eight children. His parents were, like Peter's, dirt poor. Kroll's father drank more than he worked, and he rained down regular beatings on his wife and his children. Joachim was always an outcast, the black sheep in his family, and constantly mocked and teased. He had incredibly low intelligence, which begs the question how he could have gotten away with his gruesome murders for almost 20 years. Kroll was born with massive ears that stuck out like open doors, as well as the face of a rat. Needless to say, he was mercilessly bullied at home and at school. Just like the two Eds, Kemper and Gein, his mother seemed to be the only person in his life who showed him any affection, although be it way too much. At one point, he joined the Nazi Youth League, but even there he was ridiculed and humiliated. His father apparently joined the war, and it's unclear what happened to him, but the already impoverished family hit even harder times and moved to North Rhine-Westphalia in 1945. To make ends meet, he started to work as a farm laborer, and he loved it. He liked it so much that while observing a pig being slaughtered in the butchery, he became so aroused that he had to go outside to catch his breath. He also became aroused watching a farmer artificially inseminate a cow. And none of you get a prize for guessing that Kroll would start committing bestiality, just like Peter, from a young age. Kroll had absolutely no game. He never had a single normal sexual encounter in his life. Anyone in the true crime world can tell that, with the combination of nature and nurture, this guy's not going to become an outstanding German citizen. The final straw that broke the camel's back was when his beloved mother died on January 21st, 1955. He was devastated, and this event would be the definitive point of origin in his 20-year murder spree. Joachim found work as a toilet attendant and moved into his own apartment. Apparently, Kroll would be found handing out candy in his neighborhood. His apartment was also filled with dolls, toys, and candy, and the creepy freak would invite children from the neighborhood to play at his house. Little did anyone guess that Kroll would use these dolls, often life-size, to practice his strangulation methods on. The dark urges would quickly overcome him. Just a heads up, like with Peter, there sure is a hell of a lot of premature ejaculation in this story. Mere weeks after his mother died, on February 2, 1955, Kroll murdered and mutilated 19-year-old Irmgard Stahl in a manner that might convince you that Peter Curtin had been reincarnated. After encountering her in Leidenhausen, he very clumsily tried to kiss her. She obviously recoiled in disgust, and this infuriated Kroll, who stabbed the young woman 4 times in her throat. He removed her bra and wrapped it around her blood-soaked neck and strangled her to death. Once she was dead, he started to fondle the corpse to his heart's desire. Before he could enter her with his penis, he of course ejaculated, but he stayed long enough with her to eventually get it up again, this time in her vagina. However, necrophilia and murder weren't enough for our pervert, and he made cuts similar to a butcher, removed her insides, and he shat on her semen-covered corpse. When her body was found, there was so much semen on the scene that the police were convinced that the act was done by a group of men. Tragically, Irmgard had been pregnant when she was killed in such an awful fashion. It's suspected that he raped and strangled Erika Schuter, aged 12, in 1956, and on June 16, 1959, he murdered Clara Frieder Tesmer, aged 24, in Rheinhausen. Clara fought hard for her life, but Kroll overpowered her, strangled her to death, and raped her corpse. He then cut pieces of meat from her thighs and buttocks and wrapped it in a piece of material from her own dress and took his package home to cook and enjoy it in the comfort of his own abode. As would happen a couple of times, a local mechanic was blamed for this murder. Despite his exoneration, Heinrich Art would end up committing suicide as a result of the persecution. A few months later, on July 26, 1959, Manuela Knott, age 16, would fall victim to his urge to defile. She would be found raped, murdered, and butchered. The cuts clear evidence that the culprit took the meat he'd removed for his personal consumption. Once again, the amount of semen found on the scene had police convinced that a gang was involved. This crime wouldn't be connected to the others for many years, and again, would be blamed on someone else. Joachim Kroll's landlord knew something was up with his odd tenant, and he warned Kroll that if he had any more little girls visit him unaccompanied, he would be evicted. April 23, 1962 fell on an Easter weekend, and on this Monday, the body of 13-year-old Petra Fries was found in Dinslaken. She had also been raped and strangled. Her left arm and both buttocks had been removed, and once again, a massive amount of semen was found. Monica Toffel, aged 12, was strangled, stripped naked, and masturbated upon. Again, part of her buttocks was removed. As with every single case before, someone else was blamed for the crime. On September 3, 1962, Kroll murdered Barbara Bruder, aged 12. No details about that murder are available. Joachim went dormant for about 4 years, but emerged on August 22nd of 1965. He murdered the only man we know of, the 25-year-old Hermann Schmitz, when the young man tried to intervene on Kroll's attack on another victim, who happened to be his 18-year-old fiancé he was making out with in the moonlight. Voyeurism was not going to cut it for the sexual deviant, and from the onset, Kroll wanted to kill Hermann to get to the young woman. As the two were kissing and cuddling, Kroll appeared, and Hermann stepped out of the car to speak to him. Suddenly, Kroll began to stab him, and fortunately the young woman kept her wits, jumped into the driver's side, and sped towards him. Kroll got a fright and ran away, and Hermann would succumb to his injuries in her arms. On September 13, 1966, Kroll struck again. Ursula Rowling was only 20 when she encountered the man-eater as she was taking a shortcut through a park. He choked her until she died and abused the corpse in the normal way. He would later admit to police that he was so excited that he went home and relived the experience with his dolls. And you guessed it, her fiancé was accused of the murder, and 4 months later he committed suicide because of the grief. On December 22, 1966, 5-year-old Ilana Harkey was abducted by Kroll and taken to Wuppertal, where he drowned the young girl in a river. When later asked about why he ate the flesh of his victims, Kroll would claim it was purely economical and to save on his cost of groceries. On July 12, 1969, 61-year-old Maria Hedden met her doomed fate at his hands. He punched her in the head, raped and strangled her. On May 21, 1970, Kroll followed 13-year-old Judah Rahn as she left the train station. There he ambushed her, dragged her into the woods, strangled her to death, and then undressed and brutalized her. Aside from the killings, Kroll had a very uninteresting life. He remained a loner, cleaning toilets and going on his murderous meanderings, but he did have a cat. He was a cat guy. That was until one day he decided to look at what the insides of his pet looked like and wondered what his feline friend would taste like. Fortunately, that would be the end of his pet ownership altogether. For the following 6 years, Kroll would lay dormant again. He started to have problems with pain in his legs. It could be that the limp he developed made him seem all the more troll-like and might have something to do with it, or it could have been the potentially massive ball sack he was carrying around. He did break his fast and go back to his old tactics on May 8, 1976, when he murdered 10-year-old Karen Topfer on her way to school. Like all his other victims, he raped and then strangled the child. Despite his confession, he would not be convicted of this crime after his capture. 2 months later, he would commit his final murder. 4-year-old Marion Ketter was well known to Kroll. She lived in his apartment building and had been seen with him many times before. July 3, 1976 was a humid day when the child suddenly went missing from the apartment building. Marion had been missing for an entire day when one of Kroll's neighbors encountered him on the way to the communal bathrooms. Kroll warned him not to use one of the toilets, and when the neighbor inquired why, all he replied was, "Guts." The neighbor confirmed the statement by seeing the red water and pieces of human remains himself and immediately informed the nearest police officer. In the toilet, they discovered Marion's tiny lungs, kidneys, and liver. Being they had probable cause, the police officer approached Kroll's apartment. It was clear that when Kroll opened the door, he knew the jig was up. In the kitchen, on the table, lay parts of Marion's butchered body. In a pot on the stove, amongst homegrown vegetables, they could see a pair of tiny hands floating in a simmery stew. Her entrails were plugging the sink, and in the fridge they discovered more flesh portioned for future use. Showing absolutely no remorse, Kroll admitted to strangling his little neighbor, masturbating over her body, dismembering her, and eating part of her flesh. He was immediately arrested. It's clear that Kroll had no comprehension of how serious his crimes were. His low intelligence and perhaps even psychological issues put aside, I could see time and time again he often planned and premeditated his attacks and knew how to cover his tracks. For some bizarre reason, he never thought he would go to prison. He was under the impression that some magical surgical procedure would be performed on him, and he would be cured of his bloodthirsty, flesh-raving, sexual sadistic urges, and then he would be released to return to his apartment and continue life as usual. Because he firmly believed this absurd illusion, he openly discussed his crimes with the police and would eventually confess to 14 murders. But when he was caught, he was only charged with 8. The media was obsessed with Joachim Kroll's case, and there's currently online a video available where a female officer pretends to be a victim as Kroll reenacts the murder of Clara Tesmer. It's one of the creepiest things that I've ever witnessed. Joachim Kroll's trial would begin on October 4th, 1979. On April 8, 1980, he was found guilty in the Duisburg court and sentenced to 9 life sentences. Kroll was dumbfounded, but he had to resign himself to his fate, and on July 1, 1991, Joachim Kroll would die in the Rheinbach prison from a heart attack, leaving many to wonder if he was responsible for many more murders than he was convicted of. And Joachim Kroll, the semen troll, was laid to rest. Thanks for joining us for Season 5, Episode 5 of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Suggested movies similar to today's cases: The Hills Have Eyes, a 1977 horror movie directed by the late, great Wes Craven. It's loosely based on the Sonny Bean clan. And Rabid Grannies, a 1988 trauma movie directed by Emmanuel Curvin. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs. And then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features research and writing by MR and Misdemeanor. Music by Mechanical Ghost, producer LB from the No One Likes This podcast, and The Quiet Type, as well as artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's cases are available in the credits section of our website. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.
Lee was abducted from campus. Notolo was walking home. Kevin had gone out to a meeting. Sheldine was playing in the garden. And Uyenene was in line at the post office. It Happened Here is a new true crime podcast that approaches everyone's favorite podcast genre from a journalistic and ethical perspective. One that tells victim stories and doesn't make heroes out of the monsters. It's an independent show, researched and presented by me, Kate Thompson-Davey, a true crime nerd just like you. If you like your stories intersectional, your facts accurate, and your sarcasm dry, search for It Happened Here on your preferred podcast app.
Joachim Kroll, the semen troll.